Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets, featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea's sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Margaret Chan very famously said, when we were fighting malaria, the mosquitoes didn't have a lobby group to sue us. And when we started handing out bed nets, governments didn't start suing each other for handing out bed nets and for eradicating mosquitoes.
Yeah. When
you're trying to address child obesity, it's quite different.
Hi guys, welcome back to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. Now, the Doctor's Kitchen is all about blending together the science with delicious recipes inspired by cuisines from across the world, which is what you'll see in my first book, The Doctor's Kitchen, as well as the second book, Eat to Beat Illness, out now. It's on Amazon and in all good bookstores. Today's discussion with Dr. Sandro takes a slightly different path, but it's still very, very much related. We're going to be talking primarily about answering the question posed by the Eat Foundation, of which Dr. Sandro is the CEO. Can we feed 10 billion healthy people on a healthy planet? And the answer, luckily for us, is yes. And this is what we're going to be chatting about. Here on the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, we discuss the intersection between nutrition and lifestyle across the breadth of different medical specialties. And it's just as important to consider our environment. The sustainability of our food choices ultimately impacts the health of our planet. And this is why we're talking about diet and eating for the world today. A little bit of background for Dr. Sandro Demai. He is trained as a medical doctor in Australia. He's also done a master's in public health, including some field work in Cambodia. He completed a PhD at the University of Copenhagen, focusing on non-communicable diseases. So that's things like diabetes and lifestyle-related diseases. Sandro has also held a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard Medical School between 2013 to 2015. And in April 2015, Sandro became the chief exec of EAT, the science-based global platform for food systems transformation. He also hosts the ABC television show Ask the Doctor, which is available on Netflix. He wrote a book called The Doctor's Diet, which is available in the UK. And he established a not-for-profit foundation, the Sandro Demai Foundation, which is focused on improving the health and nutrition of Australians. You can find him at sandrodemaio.com and on social media, Sandro Demai, on Instagram, Twitter. All the links will be in the show notes. You're going to find this a fascinating conversation about systems innovation, food policy, and how it affects every aspect of health and lifestyle. Let's get to the podcast. Sandro, you made it.
I did.
You did.
Almost didn't.
No, that was cool. So you flew in from Oslo?
Oslo, yeah. Wow. Arrived this morning.
Uh-huh.
Despite the best trials by a certain airline not to get me here.
Oh, really? Well, you were in London quite a bit, you were saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, we try to travel as little as possible, but London is definitely one of the ports that we find ourselves in pretty often. It's, as you know, Rupi, you're pretty lucky to live here. It's one of those kind of global capitals.
Yeah.
Growing up in Australia, always when I was young, you see, you know, those sort of high-end fashion bags that I definitely couldn't afford. Yeah. And it has, like, you know, London, Paris, New York. Yeah. It never had Northcote, Australia.
No.
So I do find myself here quite often. A lot of our collaborators are here, which is really great.
Yeah, that's great. And so the first time I came across some of your work was actually via Hazel. And we were both speaking at her conference
last
amazing.
Year.
It was awesome. Yeah. I actually had Hazel on the podcast talking about it a couple of weeks ago. And it was fascinating. And I remember going into your talk, and I'd read a bit about you. We'd interacted on Instagram and stuff, like mutual love.
I'm a huge fan, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And, dude, I was blown away by your talk.
Oh, it was, thank you.
It was, I mean, clearly you've done it a couple of times, and it was just pitched so perfectly. You know, your background and how food is intertwined with every element of our environment, our lifestyle, how it's related to conflict, how it's beyond just personal health.
Mm.
And that's why I just had to get you on here, man. And obviously talk about, you know, the Eat Foundation and all the other stuff that you're doing with your own nonprofits.
Cool.
Before we get into that, why don't we go into a little bit of your background? I did a little bit of an intro before you got here. But I feel there's so much stuff that you've done in your short lifetime. You know,
I could be 90 and just moisturize.
So, yeah, why don't you give the listeners a bit of a background to you when you come from? We know you're Australian.
Yeah, thanks, Ruby. Yeah, an Italian Australian. I always confuse people when they meet me. They hear, you know, Dottore Sandro De Maio, and they expect me to open my mouth and have like a Mario Luigi accent, and then I'm like, "G'day, mate. How you going?" Yeah, so I grew up, my name's Sandro. I grew up in Australia. I grew up in just near Melbourne. And I grew up in a big Italian family. So I have a dad who looks like he's part of the mafia. He's sort of shorter, very hairy, darker skin.
I've got to put a picture of this on the show notes.
Yeah, no worries. And then mum, who actually is Welsh background, both grew up in Australia. Amazing people. Dad's a doctor. Mum's was an occupational therapist. So grew up in an Italian family, but with a big health focus and a big focus. My mum has volunteered for decades to various causes, mostly health related, cancer related. So strong community focused family. I have two older brothers. They're both married. I have two beautiful nieces now, May and Ren, 3 and 5. I have a 95-year-old grandma, Bet, who's on Instagram.
Yeah. Nonna Bet is on Instagram.
Yeah, Nonna Bet's on Instagram. Absolutely, absolutely. And so, I grew up in this in sort of big Italian family. We have a farm about an hour south of Melbourne, and food was always central to everything we did. Mm. In the summer, we would grow and make our own passata from our own tomatoes. Mm. The taste of bottled tomatoes, when you crack open that lid and the rush of summery homegrown tomatoes, basil, garlic comes, you know, wafting out in the middle of winter. It's like, oh, you know, so making those bottles every year, preserving them.
I've got to know how you make your passata, man.
I'll send you the recipe.
You're
going to
give me the family secret recipe.
I'll come and make it with you.
Let's do that.
We can do a masterclass with it. Invite over a few people at the end of summer.
I'm going to hold you to that. Absolutely.
Done. So, and then we would also, you know, we have about 100 acres. So we would also bottle our own pears and peaches, make our own pickles. Dad would make his own prosciutto in the winter. We would kill the pig, one pig, for the entire family. And from that, we would make an entire year's food, you know, meat, salamis, salsiccia, the sausages, the prosciutto, all the preserved meats. It was a very happy pig. Mm. So you learn where food comes from.
Yeah.
From at a very early age, you have an understanding and a respect for food. Mm. But you also understand how food starts to interact with your body and the importance of food as medicine, as I know you're a great champion. But ultimately also that food is the building block of life. And what we put in our mouths at the end of the day has such a huge bearing on our health.
Mm.
So as I got older, I went to medical school. I became a doctor. Still had a passion for food, but they kind of diverged for a little while. I was doing emergency remote medicine, had an interest in diabetes and chronic disease. And what I noticed, Rupi, was that regardless of where I was working, whether it was in the biggest tertiary hospitals in Melbourne or whether it was in Sri Lanka after the Boxing Day tsunami or in Cambodia in providing healthcare in Buddhist temples, or in remote communities, in Indigenous communities in Australia, all of the populations that I was serving, all the individuals were coming in with the same diseases. And this was a group of highly preventable diseases, what we call non-communicable diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancers, chronic lung conditions, mental illness. They were coming in with diseases that we knew how to prevent. We knew how to delay. We could keep these people healthy if we chose to as a collective. And if we gave them the same opportunities that many of us take for granted, and in particular, if we improved their diet and allowed them to access affordable, nutritious, wholesome food. And so I thought, well, if I'm seeing the entire, you know, from Mongolia to Sri Lanka to remote Australia to the wealthiest communities in Melbourne, if everyone is dying from the same group of diseases that we know how to prevent, maybe my role as a doctor is, you know, whilst I have huge respect for clinicians, maybe my role actually isn't to work at the coalface treating the outcomes of disease, but maybe I need to find a way to stop the disease in the first place, to go up the river, so to speak,
and
see if you can if you can. I always think of it as sort of a cliff, you know, rather than working at the bottom of the cliff and taking the those that have fallen to their peril to hospital. Maybe there's a way we can go up and build a fence at the top of the cliff and stop people from falling in the first place. So I spent the next 3 years doing a PhD, the next two after that doing a postdoc. I was in Copenhagen, Mongolia, and then Harvard for 2 years. I did a lot of research looking at these different issues. I launched a few startups and social campaigns. And then I was lucky enough to spend 3 years working for the World Health Organization in Geneva at the global headquarters. I was an expert advisor, what's called a medical officer, on nutrition and the same group of non-communicable diseases. And that was a huge privilege. I got to work with 193 member states around the world, or countries, to try and improve, promote and protect health for vulnerable populations. And I got to see, you know, I got to see remarkably inspiring things. I got to see countries that were truly committed to improving the health of their populations. I got to see the huge progress that we're making on reducing child hunger. But I also got to see some really terrible, alarming things. I got to see industries that were blocking governments from doing what was best for their populations, particularly young kids, because they wanted to make a profit. I saw countries fighting or intervening against other countries to try and stop them from protecting their own populations. I saw decisions that were being made on ideology and profit and not based on best practice or the evidence. And I realized that whilst policy is critical and ultimately what I believe is going to solve most of the big challenges we face is far more responsible policy and responsible government, I realized that we needed to be working at multiple levels and we needed to be working in multiple sectors. So when the opportunity came up to write a book and then be the host of a television show on Australian television, which is now actually on Netflix worldwide in 300 million people have access to, I jumped at that and thought, gosh, if I can continue to work at the global policy level, but take those messages like you and Hazel do so effectively through social media and through the podcasts you guys are creating, if I can take those messages out to a wider audience, build the bottom-up movement, support those that are trying to create this bottom-up movement for change, and empower our politicians to make the right choices, but at the same time work at the global level to give those politicians the right tools, the right solutions, and help them to make those right choices. So if you can give them the support bottom-up and the solutions top-down, then maybe we'd be able to make a lot more progress more quickly. And so that's why in April of last year, I left the United Nations, my dream job, to take an even more incredible offer, which was to be the CEO of a global foundation focused on transforming the world's food systems with my Norwegian sister, Gunhild Stordalen. And I've been there since.
That you must have left that organization, like you said, your dream job, with quite a heavy heart, but a lot of aspiration, expectation going into the EA Foundation. And just remind me, when you went in April 2018, how long had EAT been around for?
So EAT had been around for about 3 years at that stage. It had been an organization for about two. The concept had been around for about three and a half. And I'd been on the advisory board right from the start. So I actually met Gunhild back when I was in the US doing my postdoc. We just clicked because we, you know, I saw that we needed to really take a systems-based approach to solving many of these big, what we call super wicked challenges, climate change, obesity. These are big challenges that have multiple causes, but also require multiple responses, multiple solutions, multiple levers across different sectors simultaneously to actually address. Yeah. They're not, you know, it's not like malaria, which is a complex global challenge, but at the end of the day, we have a solution. You know, bed nets and eradicating bodies of water and providing medicines. We can eradicate malaria. It will cost a lot, but we can do it. Obesity is a much more complex global challenge.
Yeah.
You know, Margaret Chan very famously said, you know, when we were fighting malaria, the mosquitoes didn't have a lobby group to sue us. And when we started handing out bed nets, governments didn't start suing each other for handing out bed nets and for eradicating mosquitoes.
Yeah. When you're trying to
address child obesity, it's quite different.
Yeah.
And so that's really the space where EAT works. We're a not-for-profit. We're based out of Oslo. We're a staff of 40. Most of us are under 35, though we do have some fantastic senior figures in our group as well. I'm very honoured to work alongside them. And it's an organisation that really focuses on understanding, bringing the different sectors together, but then driving through from evidence. It has to be based in evidence. We live in a world that is less and less concerned with science and truth and fact, but actually science has to be it has to underpin how we respond to these big global challenges.
Yeah.
And so we build the science, but then we also have different ways of bringing about change through partnerships with some of the biggest UN agencies, through partnerships with some of the most powerful governments on the planet, and through partnerships with scientists, businesses, civil society organizations through our global forum, which happens every June.
Yeah. I remember, actually, I'll put a show note link to the opening speech that Dr. Gunhild made last year. I think it was last year at the EAT Foundation. She's had quite an interesting past herself, right? So she is a doctor turned advocate for environmental and sustainability. You guys met whilst you were an associate professor, is that
correct?
That's
right, yeah. So I was in the US for 2 years. And it was a funny story, actually. So Gunhild has a few different hats. She's an astounding, down-to-earth individual. She's a medical doctor. She grew up in the country.
Yeah. There's an interview that you've done on the first episode of your podcast.
Yeah.
That I'll put in the show notes where you talk to Gunhild.
Yeah, she's a real kind of what we call in Australia a real larrikin. She's like, she's just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
She's you know, incredibly down-to-earth and but at the same time, kind of powerfully visionary in what she wants to achieve and how she goes about it. And so, you know, EAT really started with a question that Gunhild had, which was, you know, can we feed 10 billion people, a population that we're locked in to have on the planet in 2050? Can we feed 10 billion people that are healthy, that have actually got, you know, that have achieved, we've achieved health for all, so, you know, left no one behind, which is the agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals, the United Nations SDGs. Can we feed 10 billion people on a healthy planet. Mm-hmm. And to her surprise, there was no clear answer on whether that's possible and how to achieve it. And so she formed EAT with science at its core, but then bringing in all of these different players, business, policy, civil society, around the same table to say, well, is it possible to have 10 billion healthy people on a healthy planet by 2050? And if it is possible, then how do we achieve it? And it has to, look, let's be honest, it has to be possible.
Yeah.
Because we live in a world today where 800 million people, more than 800 million, have no choice but to wake up with too little food and go hungry every day on the same planet where more than 2 billion, that's B, are now eating too much of the wrong types of food, resulting in obesity, chronic disease, suffering, pain. So all in all, half the planet is now malnourished, while at the same time, the planet has never been richer before. We waste a third of food, and the food sector is the single biggest driver of climate change, of deforestation, of species extinction, of water use. So when you put all of that together, you know, we have to be able to feed 10 billion people by 2050. We can't continue on the path where we leave half the planet behind. That's just totally unethical, but also, you know, we shouldn't even see that as an option. So the business as usual approach is not an option. So we have to achieve 10 billion healthy people, but I want to make sure, and I know you do as well, Rupi. I have a 3-year-old niece. I have a 5-year-old niece. They'll be my age in 2050, and I don't want them to be living in a world where we don't know if we're going to be the last generation to live on a safe, sustainable, prosperous planet. You know, the future looks pretty bleak at the moment, and we have to be in a position in 2050 where not only have we not left a billion people behind at the cost of 2 billion more. But we need to make sure also that the planet we're leaving behind when we come to the end of our lives is safer, is more sustainable, and is more prosperous than we found it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that the EAT Foundation was incredible at doing is getting it to the front page of all the newspapers over the last couple of weeks. And you really got to have your head in the sand if you didn't notice what was going on with the planetary diet. And I love the name of that. But unfortunately, for a lot of people, it's just purely not on our agenda at all. I know when I'm working at A&E and I'm talking to people about food, I'm talking about food from the perspective of their personal health. And even that is a challenge. To take people that extra step further in talking to them about, yes, it's about your personal health, but it's also about the health of your environment and the health of your kids and the health of their kids as well in the future.
Well, and the health of the people around us.
Absolutely,
because
if
we continue to consume food in the way that we do in the parts of the world where I'm assuming most of your listeners come from, in wealthier parts of the world, if we continue to consume food in the way that we do, we are literally making a world where it's impossible to have everyone live healthily.
Yeah.
So we, in a way, the way we consume food leads to hunger and starvation in others. And when you think about it that way, we have a moral imperative to change the way we currently eat, to be able to bring that extra billion people into the global food system. We currently, it would be like us, you and I, eating in a tent and one person sitting outside without food, and we're okay with that. And the way that we consume food results in them being in hunger.
Exactly.
That's literally how it is, because global hunger is on the rise due to climate change and conflict, which to a large degree are driven by our food system, ironically. So hunger is driven by the production of food. But we're consuming too much of the wrong types of food in many parts of the world, including our own. But coming back to what you said, absolutely true. I mean, I was a clinician earlier in my career, and I remember, you know, people, at the end of the day, humans want to take care of themselves, and you know, it's around the hierarchy of needs, and particularly for people who have a life much tougher than ours. We're very privileged. People who have a life much tougher than ours and are more focused on where their next meal will come from, who will put a roof over their head that night, they're not going to be that focused on ensuring that the way they eat is good for the planet as well. The good news is that this diet, the planetary health diet, is actually optimal for human nutrition, period. So it's not, we're not saying that if you want to eat for the planet, eat this way.
Yeah.
We're saying if you want to have the best nutrition, if you want to achieve the best health yourself as an individual, eat this way. The good news is that if you eat this way, you will also allow the 1 billion people on the planet who currently are locked out of the food system to come in and enjoy a healthier life. But it will also result in us having to chop down less rainforest, use less water, use less nitrogen and phosphorus, which lead to leaching and death of our oceans, and it will lead to less global warming and climate change. So even if you're focused on global equity and ensuring that we don't leave a billion people on this planet behind, if you're worried about the future generations and the world they will inherit, if you're worried about simply your own health and living as long as possible and being as healthy for as long as possible, in all three scenarios, it's the same outcome.
Yeah.
This is the diet that the 37 of the world's best scientists, including the World Health Organization representative, recommend.
Yeah, and I was really happy to see it, and especially, like, you know, the breakdown and the plate and stuff, and it looks really aesthetically pleasing. Also, it's kind of in line with the way I've kind of come to believe how we should all be eating: plant-focused, whole, colourful foods.
And it's how we ate not long ago.
I mean, if you
look at my nonna,
yeah.
I mean, so the modified or the Mediterranean diet, which is pretty much like the Bible of good eating, and that doesn't mean that everyone has to start eating spaghetti and risotto and you know, rape tomorrow. I mean, they can because it's delicious. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
But it's more.
I wish we could get rape here. By the way, I was in Bologna.
Pack some next time.
Yeah,
pack
some next time. Yeah,
I grow some. I've actually got a rooftop garden in Oslo that I planted last summer. You should come visit it.
I will.
It's got a view of the fjord. We've been growing vegetables on a rooftop.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's we digress
into food.
We can't help ourselves. You know, Rupi's about to move his studio to a kitchen, and he tells me this now after I agree to come today. If I'd come in a month, you would have been cooking for me right now.
We could have
chatted over the rape. I'm actually interested to know how you cook your rape. Anyway, we'll come back to that. So the modified Mediterranean diet, you know, that was really a dietary pattern that many of our grandparents would have either eaten themselves or eaten a very close version of that, but within their own cultural context. So, you know, I've got friends whose grandparents were Chinese, and it would have been, you know, the grains would have been slightly different. Mm-hmm. But again, same thing as my Italian grandma: lots of veg, healthy oils, less fish, but quite a bit of fish in most diets. Much less red meat because it was way too expensive.
Very expensive.
It's very recent that we've been eating the levels of processed foods, red meat, even pork and chicken, and added sugar. You know, these are things that have really been added to our diets over the last 30 or so years. So anyone who says to us, you know, oh, we've been eating like this for generations and you want us to like totally change the way we're eating, it's actually, well, no, we just need to kind of undo a wrong turn that we took, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, and go back to eating, kind of rediscover the diversity of plants that we can actually enjoy, rediscover what good quality meat tastes like. Now, again, not everyone can afford organic, you know, grass-fed, air-dried, you know, Wagyu.
Yeah.
But it's about buying the best quality you can afford. It's about eating less. It's about enjoying it when you do eat it. Mm. And it's about wasting none.
This is where I see, like, almost the behavioral side of things come into play here, because we have been tricked into believing that meat does cost this much now,
yeah,
because of whatever market mechanisms we've been able to massively reduce the cost of meat through industrial processing, intensification of labor, and, you know, we almost have to like reverse that and go back and say, actually, you know what, you can get it very cheap here, but you shouldn't, because you're essentially contributing to massive environmental issues, as well as a health issue as well.
And absolutely,
I've gone into that in
and
another
there are all
podcast, but
you know, there's very strong evidence around the links of overconsumption of red meat with, you know, heart disease, diabetes, but also obviously bowel cancer. And it's, again, it's not to say that we shouldn't, you know, if you choose to be vegan or vegetarian, kudos to you, and I think that's awesome. I'm not vegan, I'm vegetarian most days, but I also eat a bit of meat. But the meat that I do eat, I really enjoy. And it's something that's seen as a privilege because it is. Ultimately, eating another, you know, another animal, it's a huge privilege. And so the planetary health diet is, I think, if you think about it in sort of three domains, that we at home can take on board and put into our everyday lives. The first is, you know, shifting our diet to something that is better for our body and better for the planet. So that's more plants, at least half the plate, whole grains, so delicious. Like, I mean, if you start with 100 or 200 grams of barley or lentils or chickpeas. I had the most amazing chickpeas from the Ord River.
Really?
Now, you probably don't know where the Ord... It's this, like, place in outback Australia.
All right.
But the chickpeas, I mean, good quality chickpeas.
I've no idea. I've never heard
so
of that.
So tasty. So I'll bring some for you next time with that up. Actually, rape and chickpeas is a great combination.
You're going to have to bring like a massive suitcase just full of food. I don't know if you're going to get through customs.
If I get tasered at Heathrow, Rupee, I'm going to come after
it's
you.
It's my problem. Yeah, sorry.
So we might have to do the next podcast in jail. Anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's about eating more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts. Nuts are such an underutilized way to get healthy oils, to get, you know, protein into our diet, to keep us full for the afternoon. You know, add a few nuts to whatever you're eating. So nuts and seeds, healthy oils, a lot of confusion around oils, but, you know, there are some really great healthy options. And then a smaller amount of chicken and fish, even smaller amounts of red meat, and a couple of eggs if you want to. Otherwise, you can substitute those for plant-based options. But so first...
So overall, like, you know, it's an incredibly healthy diet.
Yeah.
What I want to know is...
And everyone's making this, you know, this palaver about the red meat. But you know, what the science, it's not opinion. This is what, you know, 2 years by the world's best scientists tells us is the best
that's
for our
to
health.
Know, actually, because I think people just think, oh, you gave this problem to a bunch of scientists and then they just came out with this answer. It took 2 years.
Yeah. I mean, they have trawled all of the available evidence. Mm-hmm. This is not, you know, Rupee, what do you think we should eat, and sort of stick your finger in the, you know, in the air and whatever way the wind's going. It's like, no, this was 2 years of rigorous analysis of all of the latest, the best quality evidence, and they basically come up with, so the first thing is around the diet and shifting the diet. With red meat, it's basically, you know, it's been sensationalized quite a bit in the media, but, you know, the take home message is sort of a hamburger sized piece of mince once a week or a steak once a month, which, to be honest, I mean, it's not that extreme.
No, it's actually something that I talked about in my first book. I have red meat probably once every fortnight.
I do too. Yeah. And particularly, I mean, there are incredible products now where, you know, burgers that are mince mushroom mixes. I know you've done some stuff with that as well. I mean, you know, mixing different things in with your chili, like lentils, other things to kind of make the meat go further. Amazing. Like super, super tasty. The first part is around shifting the diet and sort of rethinking what you're eating in a way that's good for your body, best for your body, and also good for the planet. The second is then voting with your note, because ultimately, as you said before, our food system over the last 30 years has moved in the direction driven by consumer demand to a large degree, but also consumers have been kind of driven by marketing and all sorts of financial incentives, in the direction of eating more meat that's poorer quality, of eating fewer types of vegetables, and eating vegetables that, because we want them available all year round, they can sometimes be less nutrient dense. So the second thing is about voting for your note and actually using the money that you spend, thinking about every time I spend a dollar in the food system, I'm making a statement about the type of food system I want. So every time you buy slightly better quality meat that was given a better life, that didn't need to be treated by antibiotics because it wasn't subjected to a horrendous existence, that was killed in a reasonable way, that was, you know, where the butcher was given a good livelihood, and... and where we and also where it was actually produced in a more sustainable way, because there's huge variation depending on how you produce meat in its in the ecological footprint it has. So every time you buy meat that's just slightly better quality than you did before, maybe you're buying slightly less but slightly better quality, so the price is the same, you're shifting the market in the right direction. Mm. Because then meat producers will think, okay, people actually are willing to pay for a slightly smaller portion but of better quality beef or chicken or lamb or fish. You know, they're willing to pay for fish that we know is sustainably caught, that has been certified, that has a cost associated with certifying it, with catching it in a country where there are controls to make sure that, you know, the fish stocks are treated with respect and will still be there in 100 years. If you're willing to spend that little bit more, or even just take the time, maybe it's not even about the money, it's about taking the time, asking the question, where did it come from? Mm. You know, how was this caught? How was this grown? And then voting with your note each time to make sure we move the food system in the direction we
totally.
Want.
I totally believe, and it's something that I wrote about in the first book, that we have immense power using our dollars, our pounds, to shape the future food landscape.
Absolutely.
Where I feel that I think perhaps there's a role more for government and economic nudges, as I like to call them, is the average Joe that's not going to be listening to this podcast, that's not invested in the food, that is blinded to the analogy of us in a campsite with a tent next to people who are sleeping rough and don't have enough food to eat. Because there's a massive curtain between that. People don't understand the relevance of even within their own community about how, you know, me choosing fish that comes from overfished stocks or me choosing beef that is cheaper and therefore my family can afford it, but it's going to lead to increase antimicrobial resistance, all these different things. How do we get those people on the ground, on the average Joes who are not invested in food, who have no interest in this, to adopt a diet that ultimately leads to the salvation of a human population?
Yeah,
that's a tough.
It is tough. No. It is tough. And I mean, I think again, it comes back to you know, the hierarchy of needs. So I think most people are interested in ensuring that their family is healthy, that their community is healthy, and that ultimately the planet is healthy. But they have to, they will put their family and them, you know, they'll put them, their family first, and that's pretty reasonable. Anyone would. I think, you know, to a large degree, if those of us that can vote with our note, and also vote with our vote, it's not just forgetting, you know, next time it's time to actually vote in an election, vote for politicians. You know, this is not in the Lancet Commission, this is now me speaking personally, but, you know, it's about actually thinking, you know, who is going to represent the future and the food system of the future that I believe in, and it's also about actually just voting with your vote.
Yeah.
Because it will take, you know, I come from a background in policy, and I'm a strong believer that until the price of fruits and vegetables are brought down, until it's available and accessible, until we're able to deliver food and nutrition education to all kids, regardless of their background, not just in the wealthy hipster schools, but across all socioeconomic incomes, until kids are growing up understanding how to use food, and then they have access to it, it's affordable, and importantly, they're not being marketed to on every single corner and on their electronic device that they spend 10 hours a day staring at, from fast food companies, big soda companies, you know, all of the wrong types of foods. Until we have government step up and say, marketing junk food to kids and having super cheap soft drink that's actually cheaper than a bottle of water, and having a situation where meat is cheaper and easier to feed your kids than fruits and vegetables, until that changes, and that takes government, we're not going to solve the problem. But a big step in the right direction would come from individuals voting with their note, and individuals being cognizant of it the next time they vote in an election, and having these issues on their mind. Because I believe we do, you know, for those of us who are privileged enough to, you know, to be able to choose better quality food and vote for a food system with our money, you know, I believe we have a responsibility to do that, and we will actually start to shift the market. And, you know, it's simple economics. If half of the population or a portion of the population who can afford to starts to buy more organic or more locally produced or more seasonal or even just more fruits and vegetables, it increases demand, but that will bring greater supply to the market. The market will respond and will start to produce more. And we've seen this around the world.
Actually, we're seeing that in most local supermarkets will offer a vegan range now. And the same thing with free from aisles. Like, the free from aisle used to be the bane of most supermarkets, like a tiny little shelf. And now, like,
so what's the free from aisle?
The free from aisle is like the gluten-free, low refined sugar-free, dairy-free sort of this. Okay. And now people are fighting to get into that aisle because it's such there's such demand.
Absolutely.
You know, the health conscious sort of.
And you look at, so one example, gluten free. I'm not gluten free. And as you know, many people choose not to eat gluten. And I think that's great if that's what they want to do. And there's been this huge interest in gluten free over the last sort of 10, 15 years. Mm. And the result of that is that there are almost every product on the market now has, you know, gluten free used to be like, two things, you know, in aisle four. Now it is aisle four.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly,
and that's a good example of like where, and that aisle four is not just for one part of society. You know, yes, some of those products are more expensive, and that's an issue, and that's something the government needs to intervene in. It needs to take up the price of unhealthy foods. It needs to reduce the price of healthier foods. It needs to make sure that they're available in the poorer suburbs, and that the poorer suburbs where we know there is a saturation of junk food and fast food and takeaways, and very often a total paucity of access to fresh foods. We need to fix that, and government needs to step up and do that. But by us buying and voting a better food system, we could actually, you know, aisle four might be gluten free, but aisle five, six, and seven might be the food of the future, the food that is actually driving our food system in the right direction, a food system that brings that other billion into it, allows them to enjoy a happy life, that treats animals with respect, and that it sees us enjoy a healthy life, those around us, and also passes on a healthy planet to future generations.
Absolutely, yeah. And I loved some of the elements of your talk that I had the privilege of being at, where we actually talked about, where you talked about how food and the choice of food is related to migration, conflict, antimicrobial resistance, which is not on a lot of people's minds right now. Although in the UK here, we've had a few advertising campaigns trying to reason with people about asking for antibiotics from the doctors, and how during the flu season that shock, that like rockets right up there. And I have discussions with the patients all the time about how viruses are not treated by antibiotics, etc. But our food system is responsible for a huge proportion of the biggest.
And again, it comes back to this kind of demand that we've created, but also the market has kind of forced upon consumers in many ways of, you know, cheap, rapid, poor quality, you know, quantity over quality. And so, you know, meat in particular, it's a huge user of resources. It's a huge emitter of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases in general, methane as well. But it also uses about 70% of global antibiotics. So, you know, 3 in 10 antibiotics used on the planet are used in animals, not in humans. And to a large degree, because we actually did a story on this on Ask the Doctor, a big reason why we have to use so many antibiotics in animals is because we have them in such revolting conditions. You know, to keep them well when they're penned in a tiny space, living in total squalor, which is hugely disrespectful to the animals that we're eating. And at the end of the day, you know, where do you think those antibiotics go? They either go into the animal waste and back out into the environment, terrible situation for the environment, or we eat them and we ingest them. And yes, it's a major challenge then for resistant organisms that we're actually ingesting a huge quantity of antibiotics, and antibiotics are entering our food system and ending up somewhere.
I've witnessed this on a personal level. One of my friends, his father had to go in for an operation, just a routine elective operation for his knee, and he told me he was given a particular antibiotic that when I was a junior doctor in 2009 was third line, and I had to call the microbiologist
and beg,
we please use this because we've used XYZ, and now it's been given routinely. And I was like, wow, it's been 10 years and we've literally skipped through a whole bunch of antibiotics.
Well, scientists are worried about us running out of antibiotics.
Totally.
And we don't realise that actually by us eating, you know, cheap and nasty meat, basically, think of all the flow-on effects. Mm. We're eating more than we probably should. That has diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and bowel cancer risks. Then their environmental, you know, it uses more water, it emits more carbon, it in turn uses more. So, you know, you need to feed the animal something. It's a very poor, it's a very inefficient way of making calories for a global population where 800 million people are still hungry, to use food to feed an animal and then use the animal to feed a human. Mm. You know, yes, I'm not vegetarian or vegan. Yeah. I eat meat, but by when we demand a lot of it at a very low cost, we find ways, the market finds ways of making it as efficiently as possible. So it ends up being, you know, feedlots with grain fed, where the grain is coming from land that used to be rainforests. It takes a huge amount of energy to produce and ship the grain, and then you end up feeding it to animals that live a poor life, and then getting it to market only to be overconsumed and cause disease. I mean, in humans, and the only way you can get it to market and keep the animal healthy for long enough is to give them a whole bunch of antibiotics in the process. So, you know, that seems like a crazy, that doesn't seem a very sustainable way of approaching animal source food
and consumption. And this is what happens when market forces essentially dictate what the demand is and what's available. I mean, like, you know, we've been taught to have meat in our diet as part of a healthy diet, yes, but also it's associated with wealth, which is why in growing economies like India and China...
Aspirational, exactly.
And that's absolutely why they have increased meat consumption. What I found interesting about your talk is one of the observations that we in the West, for want of a better term, eat too much meat, but there are populations around the world that eat too little. How do we actually readdress that balance? It's not as simple as like, okay, well, the meat that we're consuming we send over to wherever they need.
No.
Was that something that was included in the report?
It is, absolutely. So the recommendations in the report are, again, dramatic reductions for parts of the world like of red meat and most animal source foods for, you know, UK, Australia, the US, where we're consuming 4 or 5 times. Australia, for example, I was there just last week and, you know, we're consuming about 5.5 times what is recommended in the Planetary Health Diet, even about 20% more than the National Dietary Guidelines. So, I mean, Australians are eating 0.5 kilogram of red meat a week.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy.
It's a lot.
I mean, it's 5 hamburgers a week. Who is eating this meat? I'm not eating this much. Yeah. You're not eating this much. Someone's eating this much.
A lot of people, they have this misconception of Australia just being Sydney and Bondi. And, like, you know, everyone's healthy. Everyone's got, like, that LA-style lifestyle. And like, everyone's eating, like, you know,
Buddha bowls. It's the same in many, you know, in many high-income countries.
Yeah.
And that's for a whole number of reasons. You know, urbanization, westernization, the influx of global corporations, you know, influencing our food system, the so-called kind of westernization or McDonaldization of our diets. But the reality is that there are still, as I said, you know, 830 million people who go hungry, and there are still hundreds of millions of particularly young women who are anemic, who don't get, who would benefit enormously from having a little bit more meat and animal source proteins in their diet. And kids as well. You know, there's a critical period of growth, the first 1,000 days, but also, you know, early in life when children really benefit from having eggs and a small amount of meat, high quality animal source foods in their diet. It helps their brain to develop. It helps in general nutrition lay down the foundations for a healthy life. But the way that we're eating in the West, quite frankly, takes away that opportunity for hundreds of millions of kids living in poverty worldwide. And so, particularly in the context of climate change. And again, this sad irony that, you know, the way we're eating is driving to a large degree a change in our climate. The change in our climate is driving, is increasing hunger after decades of reductions. It's once again on the rise. Like, that is a sad indictment on our planet,
really sad,
that after decades of reductions, you know, global hunger is once again on the rise due to climate change and conflict. And conflict, you look at, you know, when have been the major conflicts over the last 10 years? Many of them, even the last few decades, many of them are linked with rises in food prices. Because food, you know, when people can't access food, again, goes back to what we were talking about of the hierarchy of needs. When it goes back to I can't put food on the table for my family, then of course people are going to worry about their family before they start worrying about their community and before they start worrying about the planet. So whether it's for the planet or whether it's for the individual, we actually need to find a way, you know, of sustainably feeding the entire global population. And and that will involve actually increasing the amount of meat and animal source proteins that hundreds of millions of people across the planet are eating, because they're eating too little, resulting in disease and malnutrition. But to make space for them to be able to achieve optimal health on a limited planet. The planet seems big, but actually,
resources,
we've only
limited.
Got one of them. If you use a resource in one place, you can't use it in another. You know, we have used half the planet's land space to grow food. That's where we're at now. We use half the planet. We can't use any more because we need the rest of it to maintain biodiversity, to maintain important ecosystems, to provide energy, to provide all of the other, you know, services that that our ecology and that our nature provides to human beings and to the planet itself, and to safeguard the planet. We can't use any more space to grow food. So we need to find more efficient ways of growing food. And if it's hugely inefficient and damaging to produce certain types of foods in a certain way, and they're the same types of food that are most hazardous for our health, then it makes a lot of sense.
I'm super interested in the whole concept of how we produce more with less. There's, I think, a lot of application for technology in the future. The Netherlands are a fantastic example of how they are able to pump out so much produce with limited land supply, and harnessing the technology of greenhouses. I've got a friend of mine, actually.
And I have to say, how much better are the tomatoes from the Netherlands now than they were 10 years ago?
I know.
They actually taste like a tomato now.
So they've definitely refined a lot of the things. But a lot of people don't realise that a lot of our saddle leaves come from the Netherlands and just how much.
They're an enormous producer.
Incredible.
For a tiny country.
I mean, we're getting better in the UK, but I think with environmental challenges that we're just talking about, and those that are set to worsen, you know, we have to be quite careful. We have to harness technology.
And there are, I think there are a couple of really important, you know, things to drive home. The first is that, you know, currently a lot of food, our food systems are still very inefficient. I mean, they're very efficient in some ways, but they're not as efficient as they could be. There is a gap between what we could produce on half of the planet's land and what we do produce, and we need to close that gap. Okay, so we need to make, we need to find ways, technologies, again, voting with our note, that's what we can do as consumers, making sure our governments are making the right choices, supporting companies that are doing the right thing, investing in new technologies, new farming practices, supporting farmers who are growing food in a sustainable way, and in an efficient way that is going to feed a growing population. So it's about, it's about you know, growing food more efficiently on the land we have, using all the technologies we have, everything from, you know, using satellite imagery to work out if crops are growing at the right pace, whether they need more or less fertilizer, and also whether they need more or less water, through to really incredible technologies that are being developed in Australia but rolled out in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, where they simply have a device that they plunge into the soil at the in a smallholder farmer. So smallholder farmers are, you know, those that are growing food on a very small amount of land, tend to be in the poorest parts of the world. There are about 500 million of them, and they feed most of the people on the planet still today. Mm-hmm. So if we can equip smallholder farmers, for example, with a really simple piece of technology that allows them to better understand whether their crops need more or less water, to time that and to understand if they need more or less fertilizers, then we, you know, we use less water, we use less fertilizer. That's saves them money. Mm. They get better yields. That brings in more money. And what does that lead to? It leads to social and economic development. It leads to people being pulled out of poverty. It leads to countries continuing to develop, and it leads to, you know, a more prosperous global population. So it's all from, you know, Google using satellites down to really simple technologies to close those yield gaps to make growing of food as efficient as possible.
It's almost like we need a collaborative effort amongst all different governments across the world to really try and devise systems that can operate, that can optimize growing,
yeah,
increase yield and reduce the energy input.
And this is exactly what EAT was established for, and this is exactly what we do. And we also work with incredible research collaborations like CGIAR, but also there are similar initiatives around the world where there are teams of scientists, teams of innovators working on how we can improve the way we grow food, because that's critical.
Yeah.
But a last part, so the first one is shifting our diet and using policy, but also individual choices when we have them to eat the diet that's in line with people and planet. The second is voting with our note. We need to actually support innovation, support farmers, support companies, support governments that decide to or that are actually bringing about the innovation that is going to deliver a more sustainable and efficient food system. And the third is around food waste. We can't talk about the future of food without addressing the fact that a third of food across the planet is currently wasted.
It's crazy, though. I don't think people realize
it's
that.
Insane.
I mean, it's down to the little bits of food that you have in your fridge.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the huge supermarket chains that have to throw away so much produce purely because they want to roll the shelves and have everything available to us, because there's an expectation from the consumer now that we have food at any season.
Yeah.
And at every point.
And that it's abundant, it always looks fresh, it always this, that, and the other.
It's polished.
But it is important to understand two facets of the food waste challenge. The first, and that is the difference between food loss and food waste, because both of them are huge challenge globally, and combined it's a third of food. If we can simply reduce food waste to a quarter, we will go a huge way, because we won't have to produce as much food that produces carbon, uses water, uses fertilizers, et cetera, et cetera. The flow-on effects of actually using every part we grow would have enormous benefits on our environment alone. So food loss is pre-market. So it's in low and middle-income countries, in poorer parts of the world, the vast majority of food that never gets consumed is in the form of food loss. So that's food that never makes it to the marketplace. Again, if you have a smallholder farmer, you know, you're a family in Malawi growing on a small plot of land, a couple of acres maximum, maybe even just 1 acre, and you grow a certain amount of food. If a third of that food never makes it to the market because you don't have a refrigeration system, because you don't have the technologies to know when is the best time to pick, because you get it to the market, but the market is, you know, not wanting to buy, or the prices are not right, or whatever else, and it leads to spoilage. If a third of that food is wasted for that smallholder farmer in Malawi, that is a third of their income that they lose. And that's, again, another barrier to social and economic development. It's another barrier to pulling themselves out of poverty, their kids, putting their kids in school, all of the flow-on effects to addressing poverty. And you think, what does poverty have to do with food waste? Well, now you start to connect the dots. Food waste, though, is at the other end of the food chain, and that's primarily what we have in countries like yours and mine, in Australia, in the UK, in Europe, in America. It's actually post-market. So it's in the supermarkets, it's in the restaurants, it's in our own homes. And that's food that is not perfect and therefore doesn't get used. Yep. It's food that we buy because it says, you know, buy three for the price of one, but we don't actually need three. It's food that is in a buffet that people don't eat and therefore gets thrown away. It's food that maybe has, you know, a slight imperfection in the fruit shop or in the supermarket, etc. So food loss is pre-market. That's generally in the poorer parts of the world. Food waste is aftermarket. It's generally in the wealthier parts of the world. But both are critically important. Both have slightly different solutions. Mm. Obviously, food loss, it's a lot about investing in technologies. It's about giving particularly smallholder farmers across the planet the ability to get their food harvested, transported to market. You know, it's about keeping it cool in really hot countries. It's about giving them the technology to pick and transport it at the right time, etc. And then in countries like our own where it's food waste, it's again the same two things. It's about us, you know, being more cognizant of it, having a list, buying only what we need, having a flexible... I love the way you cook, Rupi, because it's like a very flexible way of cooking. Mm. It's not, you know, 412 steps to make a whatever it is. Yeah. And you think, oh, God, I don't have, you know, 12.6 grams of this really esoteric spice, so I can't make it. It's like whatever you've got in your cupboard, if you can cook from what's in your cupboard, if you have a basic set of recipes that can be adapted and be flexible, use the last of whatever you have, combine it with the quarter of the aubergine and the third of a bag of carrots, so all of that doesn't go to waste. They're the sorts of things that you can do to reduce food waste. You know, have a list and stick to it when you go to shop. Use that list to plan. If you're not a great cook, then make a bit of a list of the things you're going to eat that week.
Like elevating people's like culinary confidence, I suppose, to utilize those last
and bits a bit of planning, and then you know, also set yourself a challenge. In Norway, the city council collects all food waste, and they collect it in little green plastic bags that gets recycled, but then the waste gets composted. It's quite amazing.
Yeah.
But what I do is, and what all of my colleagues at our office has, we kind of have a running joke and a competition of kind of if the food waste in the bag has gone completely moldy before you have to tie the top off and put it in the bin, then you know you're doing really well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you can try and fill only one of those bags every 3 months, then, you know, basically it's about thinking, actually being cognizant of the amount of food we're putting in the bin. Can we be using it to make a soup? Can I use the leftovers to make a frittata or something else? Can I, you know, use the last of the eggplant and throw it in the stir fry? No, Rupi's recipe didn't have eggplant in it, but it's going to be tasty anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Food waste, both need to be addressed.
Yeah. I love the way you clarified that, actually, food loss and food waste. And I'm really excited by the number of different companies that are harnessing technology to tackle food waste.
Yeah.
A couple that come to mind are Too Good To Go.
Oh, my God, I love Too Good To Go.
They're great, right?
Yeah.
So for those who don't know...
By the way, we're not paid by them.
We're not paid by them. I'll put a link in the show.
I also thought it's such a great concept.
Yeah,
so in the last 15 minutes of service, the restaurants in the area, based on your location, say, hey, Rupi, there are like 3 veggie burritos at this place around the corner that are going to go to waste. We'll sell them to you for like £2 instead of £5.
Yeah,
it's and again, you think like, what are the flow-on effects of that? But it's also providing, you know what... Friends of mine who are students, friends of mine who you know, are price sensitive, it actually also gives them an opportunity to... Like, it's perfectly good food. It's not like feeding waste.
No, it's perfectly
good food.
Yeah, and I like that. It's because it's including those who are probably marginalized from the conversation because they can't afford that seasonal organic produce, and including them in the effort to improve the environment, essentially, which is why I absolutely love that. And then there's another one called... Olio,
you might have heard of.
Olio, literally, I think it's just incredible. So when you know you're not going to be able to use that red pepper, and perhaps you're going away for the weekend, you've got these eggs and they're going to go out of date, instead of just allowing them to go to waste, you just post it on Olio, and then someone in the local area will be like, I'll pick those up, and they'll come around to your house.
So when I've got half a bag of rapé, I'll just pop it on Olio, and then you'll come over.
I'll just come over and pick it up. Yeah, it's great.
The order of a chickpeas and the in the rapé. It's going to be on Olio next week, buddy.
Definitely, mate. I can already think of a whole bunch of recipes. So just before we end, we're going to go to rapid questions at the end.
Cool.
I feel like we talk about like this for a couple more hours, but I know you've got another appointment to go to. But have you, going back to the Planetary Diet, have you had any criticism at all,
yeah,
or opponents to it? And what have they been saying?
Sure.
Anything?
There have been a number of criticisms. The first has been criticism of our founder. Our founder is quite wealthy and donates all of... I mean, she doesn't take a wage from all of the work she does. She donates her time, but she's able to do that because she comes from a family that's quite wealthy. And there's been criticism of kind of...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
So there's criticism of her lifestyle, which, you know, it's, you know, it's totally unrelated to the report and the quality of the report and even the work as a foundation. And it's really a personal attack.
Yeah, it sounds like a personal attack
on her, and it's been pretty disappointing. But anyway, she understands and that, you know, she has a profile and she's making waves in the world, and people will want to cut you down when you do that. The second has been totally false accusations around, you know, our accused links with industry. And let me make it very, very clear that all of the research that we do, all of the policy we do, is funded by a not-for-profit trust charity based here in the UK. It's one of the largest medical research funders in the world. All of our... there was no involvement. There was no input. There was no consultation. There was no peak preview. There was no funding from any private sector company or entity in the preparation or even the launch of this landmark scientific report. It was developed by 37. It was created by 37 of the world's leading scientists. They weren't even paid. They did it basically for free.
Wow.
Just simply covered their costs to participate, and then launching it, everything was paid for by not-for-profit sources.
Wow.
So that's the second thing that's really important to understand. And the third have been some accusations around the quality of research and the quality of studies that were included. And look, this is again...
You're going to get that in every report.
Look, and disappointingly, when you look at those individuals that have been throwing these accusations at us, many of them are funded by the meat industry or funded by individuals who have an interest in discrediting a diet that is lower in meat in particular, which is very disappointing, but, you know, it's probably to be expected. But one thing that, you know, I suppose we are cognizant of, and you are as well, is that very often in public health research, we're not able to do what we call interventional studies. So, you know, we have to follow very large numbers of people over time and then kind of observe what happens and say, okay, if these, you know, this portion of people seem to be eating more meat and they seem to have these outcomes associated with it. Now, there is so much evidence of the linkage between meat and cancer, for example, that the United Nations have declared that it, you know, that there is a link that needs to be observed and warned to populations. But having said that, it's still, we're not able to get two, you know, two cities, give one city meat and the other one not, and then follow them over time like we would do with, you know, animal studies, interventional studies. And so people who want to criticize very often public health research and nutrition research, they will say, oh, well, you're only watching people, you're only using observational evidence, and that's poor quality. And I mean, again, you know, if we had two planets and two populations and one of them all agreed to go vegetarian for 6 months, or all agreed to only eat you know, fish on Tuesdays, or all agreed to only eat purple carrots, then, you know, yeah, we'd be able to do interventional studies. But we don't have two planets. It's not ethical to ask people to eat or not to eat certain things very often, particularly children. You can't do that. And so we have to rely on observation. And also people tend not to stick to diets that you ask them to go on. I don't know that that as a doctor.
Absolutely.
You know, very often you'll say, you know, Mrs. Smith, what did you eat yesterday? She forgets the three Mars bars. Yeah. She tells you the two apples that her son ate. And, and you know, and then when you ask her to reduce, to change what she's eating, she might tell you she has, but very often, you know, she doesn't.
Yeah. In nutritional research, just for the listeners, you know, food frequency questionnaires are notorious for being very inaccurate, unfortunately. But
it is,
what you're
but
saying
it is the
is
best
that,
evidence that we have.
Exactly. And, so you're and it's using also, the best available evidence that you have to essentially formulate what.
But it's also not just Mrs. Smith. It's it's literally 350,000 Mrs. Smiths followed for 55 years.
Yeah.
12 times over, because there are a number of these very large scale studies that have been used to inform. I mean, this is the gentleman who, the two people who led this are the most cited researchers in the world. You know, they understand the limitations of the research, and that's in there as well. But this is the best assessment possible based on existing science, and it wasn't funded by industry in any way. They had no involvement. We are a not-for-profit organization. I am a vehement protector of the integrity of policy and science from influence of any sort. And you know, whether my founder you know, has been given a more or less fortunate deck of cards in life is totally irrelevant. The point is that she's dedicated her life to improving the health of the planet and the planet's population.
Absolutely.
And this is a landmark report based on solid science.
Yeah. One of the features of the summary that I'll put into the show notes for sure is how you formulated what is best for the environment, what is best for the human, for human health, and then what the middle section of the Venn diagram, essentially. Is there any opportunity cost associated with a diet such as the planetary diet to personal human health to sacrifice for the environment? Do you see what I'm that question?
No, I understand. So one of the concerns is around some of the B vitamins, and the World Health Organization does recommend supplementation in certain populations of vitamin B12 and a few other nutrients. And in this diet, in those populations, there may still need to be supplementation, but that's the case even in most current diets. So the recommendation for pregnant women, you know, to take folate, that would be the same in the planetary health diet. This is a diet that is really a recommendation for healthy adult populations, based on a 2,500 calorie diet, which is a reduction on what you know many populations are currently eating, and that comes back to again the overconsumption question.
Anecdotal note as well, the number of people that I see that are deficient in key nutrients who have an omnivorous diet, you know,
absolutely,
it's
huge. I mean, the macronutrient rich, micronutrient poor diet of the West that's now fueling an epidemic of what we call the double burden of malnutrition, of obesity but micronutrient deficiency, because people are eating huge amounts of processed macronutrients with very few micronutrients in them, is a huge problem. And it's a huge problem across, again, many of the populations that we are part of. A diet that is more micronutrient dense, more diverse, more plant-based, and with less processed foods, less poor quality meat, and also less unhealthy fats, I mean, that would go a long way to improving the health of pretty much every person on this, well, every person on this planet, and then some.
Yeah.
I mean, there will be winners and losers in achieving this diet at a planetary scale. There will be trade-offs. There will be companies that make a lot of money these currently from selling pretty crappy food to vulnerable populations. But we as a collective need to decide that that's a trade-off we're willing to take to protect those vulnerable populations, to protect ourselves, to protect the planet. And, you know, we will need to think through some really difficult scenarios, like, you know, countries that most countries want to make sure that they can feed their own population, food security and food sovereignty, that food comes from their own country. You know, these are some of the questions we need to work through, because actually we need to build and even, we need to actually increase trade. We need to build a world where we grow food where it's grown most efficiently, and then we trade it for the foods that we can grow most efficiently using the least resources. You know, we are one planet at the end of the day, and we need to have a food system that reflects us, that reflects that. But there will also be big parts of Central and South America, Southeast Asia, that we need to keep as pristine rainforests to preserve the lungs and the ecosystems of the planet. So we need to make sure that those populations don't then lose out, because they're taking they're taking a larger burden of protecting ecosystems instead of growing food. Those other parts of the world that can grow food because they don't have those, you know, incredible biodiverse ecosystems like tropical rainforests, that they are then great trading partners, that they are actually understanding that, you know, the parts of the world that continue to preserve our ecology for future generations, that there's a cost associated with that. And we actually think about reimbursing the preservation of those rainforests in ways that reflects the environmental, the health, and the economic benefits that it will bring to our planet.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to wrap up with some rapid questions. You up for this?
Sure.
All right, these are questions that people have just shouted in because they want you to offer some quick advice or quick sort of like opinions.
Getting nervous, don't worry about it.
It's cool. Okay, what does a typical planetary diet day look like? Let's just give one meal example. Go for it.
So my homemade muesli, some natural yogurt or some soy yogurt, and some seasonal fruit.
Brilliant. Are there particular vegetables that wouldn't be suitable for us in the UK to eat from a planetary environmental standpoint?
No. The world will need to continue to trade and be one food system. The only thing would be poor quality meat.
Great. And so that answers the second, the other question. Should I stop buying bananas?
No.
Okay.
Actually the efficiency of trade, if it's shipped on a ship and not in an aeroplane, the carbon intensiveness, so it actually takes more energy to grow a banana here in the UK than it does to ship it from South America or wherever. So, you know, as long as we're eating food that has been shipped on by a ship and not an aeroplane, we're not eating Wagyu beef or a sashimi that's been flown in overnight, you're pretty safe.
Okay. Do the vegans think this is drastic enough, or do we need to go vegan to save the planet?
We don't need to go vegan. If you want to be vegan, you can be perfectly healthy. There will be people on both sides who say that they want to see less meat and they want to see more meat. This is based purely on science.
Great. Oh, we've answered this question, I think. Is it sustainable from a health perspective, the planetary diet?
It is.
Good rapid answer. What are your thoughts on organic food and organic agriculture?
Love it if you can afford it. We need to make sure it's affordable for all, and we need to understand that it's not about necessarily the food being healthier or more environmentally sustainable, but it comes then to a different issue that we haven't talked a lot about, which is pesticide use, which is a whole nother kettle of fish.
Yeah. Do you think we have to go organic, or that's what we should be aiming for as a food landscape for environmental reasons for over pesticide use, do you think?
I think moving towards more organic methods, it makes a lot of sense for the planet. It's not a recommendation from the Lancet, but, you know, if we can find ways of producing just as much food without pesticides, it would be a much better situation for the planet, absolutely.
Yeah, I believe that. Meatless meat. Do you think meatless meat has a place in the planetary diet? So we're talking about the
absolutely.
Impossible Burger.
It absolutely does. But there are lots of things that we can do without having to grow meat in a lab, which will, you know, entertain Los Angeles and feed, you know, hipsters in London, but is unlikely anytime soon to solve the global food crisis. So instead, what we can be doing is, you know, eating slightly less, eating better quality, driving the market in the right direction, looking at plant animal mixes. We talked about like the mushroom beef burger, but also looking at just totally vegetarian options or vegan options. I mean, some of the veggie burgers out there are super delicious.
Yeah.
You don't actually need to grow meat on a Petri dish. You can actually just use plant-based proteins.
Yeah, I totally believe that as well. If there's one thing you'd change about my diet, what should it be? What extra ingredients should I be having in my diet?
I think starting with plants, starting with vegetables. I think if you begin the meal with how am I going to make veggies the hero of this dish, and then build out from there, even if meat ends up being, you know, a last sort of condiment, start with veg, build out from veg, you can't go wrong.
What's your veggie hero?
Eggplant.
Nice. I like that. Have you seen the graffiti eggplant?
I thought you were going to ask about the emoji. I thought, oh God, here we go. We're going to get ourselves into trouble.
No, graffiti emoji. Have you seen the graffiti emoji? The graffiti aubergine.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's amazing.
You have to send it.
This amazing, I'll give you that in exchange for some rapé.
Done.
Nice.
And some Ord River chickpeas.
A passionately informative podcast there with Dr. Sandro. He really is an inspirational character. I can't believe the number of things he's done, and I really hope you found that informative and useful. I think we all have a responsibility, yes, but also it's very actionable. And I hope just from our conversation, you understand how easy it can be to look after our own health and our planetary health as well. Yes, it is controversial. Yes, we are always going to have caveats with any research we do in nutrition, but we have to do the best we can with the resources we have and the tools at our disposal. To summarize, the transformation to healthy diets by 2050 will require a big shift in how we are currently eating, which is largely meat focused, but really increasing the consumption of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and legumes, things like chickpeas that we talked about a lot, but also broad beans, adzuki, black beans, whatever types of beans that you like, will need to increase by double. And fortunately, my book, The Doctor's Kitchen, and the new book, The Doctor's Kitchen, Eat a Bit Illness, will encourage you and give you actionable ideas on how to do this. The consumption of foods like red meat and sugar will have to be massively reduced. And this is for not only our personal health, but also from the perspective of our environmental health as well. As is stated in the Eat Lancet report that I will link to in the show notes on thedoctorskitchen.com, global food production threatens climate stability and ecosystem resilience. It constitutes the single largest driver of environmental degradation and transgression of planetary boundaries. Now, this sounds super, super scary, but really, eating according to the principles of healthy eating that I discuss in my books and also in the planetary diet is something that's very actionable for a lot of people, and you could be doing a lot of good from an environmental and personal health standpoint. Make sure you check out Sandro De Mayo on Instagram at Sandro De Mayo. Thedoctorsdiet.com.au is a link to his book, and it's out in the UK too. Eatforum.org is the Eat Foundation, and his own foundation, SandroDeMayoFoundation.org, is another link on the show notes on thedoctorskitchen.com. You can also check him out on ABC or on Netflix on the program Ask the Doctor. And if you didn't know already, Eat to Beat Illness is out now. You can check it out on Amazon and all good bookstores. And it has tons of ways in which you can eat according to the planetary diet principles. If I was to recommend one recipe that will round up exactly what we've talked about in today's podcast, it would be the Ethiopian Berberi curry with tomatoes, different sorts of greens, lots of plant-based foods, and tons of flavor. You're going to absolutely love it. It's on page I can't remember, but it's definitely in the book, so make sure you go get it. I'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.